So this is the first event within the residency of Montrose Press Radio, award Mr. Isiting Rimay. And my sub-residency is pretty much focused on Latin American art and its assimilation in the West. Its name, Walk with the Devil, after a book of essays by Cuban curator Gerardo Mosquera, who was also the founding member of the Bienal de La Habana. And pretty much this, he made some essays on art, internationalism, and cultures. And this research of mine pretty much stems from what I was intrigued during my university days, very much influenced by an exhibition I saw in Mexico City at the Jumex Museum, titled Under the Same Sun, by Pablo León de la Barra, a Mexican curator. And what intrigued me was how really can one make exhibitions that encompass like a non-hegemonic view of Latin American art, and how really can, yeah, those artists be grouped together, the questions about cultural assimilation and self-exotization that go into that. And actually that exhibition was made first for the Guggenheim Museum and then taken to Mexico City. But anyhow, for this research and this inaugural talk titled The Same Way, Walk with the Devil, I wanted to have like the perspective of a cultural worker such as Patrick Charpenel, who is the director of Museo del Barrio here in New York City, and Ignacio Gatica, a Chilean artist who relocated here about 7 years ago. And yeah, his work is about the systems of knowledge, economic models, and language. And to kick off the conversation, I wanted to start first talking about not only the relocation to New York, as you both are like first wave immigrants here, but also how we really not come from a pure culture of Mexico or Chile. It's very much also influenced by the neoliberal economic models that have played a big part in the countries we come from. In Mexico, we have NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement in the 90s. But this was something that was already done in Chile a few decades before. So my first question is to Ignacio, how does this context that you grew up in really influence the worldview you have and the practices that you're now making?
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Fabiola, for inviting me, Montes Press Radio and Canal Project too, and thank you, Patrick, too. I think, that subject of U.S. intervention in the within the economic model of Chile, right, has informed me because basically I was born in a country that was, you know, modified by this injected ideology, let's say, economic ideology, right? So how I see it in my practice, at least, is like somehow a question that it has to be resolved. And the question could be with like related to folklore somehow, of like how, what's the real folklore that I'm aiming to, you know, kind of resignify when every day, you know, like what's been touching my body, my mind, you know, my experience living. So, for example, I try to trace those elements that really inform this everyday living, and then understand them as my own and resignify them. I think by moving to New York, that was accentuated, and I assimilated how well what was the source, pretty much. And
And in those terms, what do you think has been those changes when you came here? What are those particular differences? Because the other day we had a wonderful studio visit together, and you were showing me a video project that you were working on right now that they call the financial area of Santiago, Sanhattan. So what do you think are like these nuances that are perceived when you are here that cannot be perceived when you are in Santiago, for example?
I mean, when I'm here, I see what it was resonating there before in my memory somehow, but I think also it's like that memory, like I see it somehow comically dislocated by the original, let's say, right? Kind of like that specific area that Fabiola is talking about, that's kind of like the main interest of that video piece. It's the biggest financial district in South America, and it's in Santiago. It's 10 minutes away where my mother lives when I grew up, and they name it colloquially Sanhattan, right? Like Santiago, like Manhattan, Sanhattan. So there is a few buildings, there is somehow like inspired architecture from New York that's been replicated, but mostly somehow like the ideology that's been replicated in somehow an imposed speed that the city really doesn't have, the landscape doesn't have, but somehow is there, you know, electrifying these streets or something, but or this part of the city. But when I'm here, I see it every day, you know, like I see the stars again, like. So yeah, I think.
And for you, Patrick, before you came here to work at Museo del Barrio, you were acting as the director of Museo Jumex. And of course, this is a very different context. Jumex Museum is within the Polanco neighborhood of Mexico City. And here, the Museo del Barrio is in El Barrio, in East Harlem, and where it has like a rich demographic of Puerto Rican artists, Latin Americans, Mexicans, African Americans. So what has been for you the major differences of working in an institution that from here promotes Latin American art as opposed to working in a museum in Latin America in terms of the concepts, in terms of the program, and in the audience?
Well, it's really the opposite. When I was running Museo Jumex, it was a museum who was running an international program of contemporary art. It was an institution with a lot of capacity, economic capacity. So he had the possibility of producing very complex and ambitious exhibitions. We didn't need to do fundraising. It was a youth company. This museum is a corporate museum. Funded by one of the biggest Jewish companies in Latin America, and it was done with the purpose of bringing international art to Mexico, opening different conversations between the local production of Mexico and the international production of the U.S. and mainly Europe. So when I came, obviously, I did try a lot to focus in the production of local artists. For me, it was very important that if I was running an international museum in Mexico, not to lose focus and to have as a central concern the production, the local production of Mexican art. So that was, for me, very, very important to really open a conversation, to establish different kind of complex connections between the local production of Mexican art and the international production of the U.S., Latin America, and Europe. When I came here, I immediately understood that I was not coming to run a Latin American museum in New York, because the Museo del Barrio is not a Latin American museum. The main focus of the Museo del Barrio is Latinx. That means we focus on the production of Latinos in the U.S. One of the things that is happening, it's very easy to find international galleries that represent Latin American artists, but it's very difficult to find U.S. galleries representing Latinos, Latinx artists. A long time ago, El Museo del Barrio was in charge of curating a section of the Frieze Art Fair in New York. And that section had the purpose of opening a conversation between the production in Latin America and the Latinx production in the U.S. It was very, very easy to find galleries that were representing Latin American artists, but it was very difficult to find galleries, U.S. galleries, representing Latinx artists. So the focus on El Museo del Barrio is really to bring complexity to the production of Latinos in the U.S., and mainly showing that this production, it has been historically invisibilized, and the role of an institution like the Museo del Barrio is not only to give a voice to those community and all that production, but it's mainly to rewrite the cultural history of the U.S. by including the production of Latinos, and showing that that production plays a very important role in the construction of U.S. identity. So basically, what is I find extremely exciting is that we're running what we call a culture-specific institution. And what I find so fascinating about culture-specific institutions is that they're not like airports. I think the big international museums are becoming like airports. They're designed by the big architectural stars, las firmas de arquitectos grandes, and they're programming and collecting the same artists, like the big stars, the mainstream artists. So if you go to very big institutions in Europe or in the U.S., museums, you will find that they're programming the same exhibitions and collecting the same artists. What is really fascinating about institutions like the Studio Museum in Harlem or the Museo del Barrio is that we're really organizing different projects around artists that have no visibility. I think incredibly talented and incredibly interesting, but that the only way to really get to see this kind of production is going to institutions like El Museo. So this is what it makes it so exciting to be now running an institution like El Museo.
And you both came around the same time to the U.S., which was around 2016, 2017. I believe the world has changed very much since then. Here in the U.S., of course, they had many changes, such as Trump won the elections, and the pandemic happened, movements such as Black Lives Matter. I wanted to ask you a bit, both of you, how were those social and political changes that were happening here in the U.S. affecting your practice? I know, Ignacio, you did a series called Fantasmas, which was a series of photographs of empty storefronts during the pandemic. So did that in any way was influence what you were seeing here, and also did that inform the things that you were seeing in Chile? Were you physically there between the back and forth in the both sides?
Yes, I somehow managed to travel to Chile within the pandemic for a few months before it really shut down borders here and there. But in Chile was happening this big protest movement that changed completely the landscape of the city too, and like a bunch of like political discussions that were happening back there. And then I came back to New York and COVID strikes, and then like I see stores shutting down and boarding up their facades too. So that kind of like resonance somehow like really moved me, and I started like schizophrenically like trying to like, you know, trace connections. But then what really moved me was seeing in Madison Ave and, you know, like these big open mall spaces from New York City, basically open air malls, that their stores were being empty up, and like the plants inside weren't being watered and all that. Somehow that decay really like attracted me. As I saw a city basically shutting down, and then what that means in a city like this being stopped radically, symbolically for me was almost like thinking of Rome, you know, after the decay of Rome, right? So I wanted to crystallize that moment by taking those photographs that you're talking about. But and yeah, I mean, I feel like that was inspiring for me somehow, you know.
And in your case, Patrick, during 2020, you started La Trinal del Barrio, which was actually taken from another exhibition that was made in the early 2000s, right?
Yeah, even before.
Okay.
The S-Files.
Yeah. The S-Files, yeah. And this Trinal was called Estamos Bien. So it opened on 2021 at the end, but it's pretty much a large-scale national survey on Latinx artists. I wanted to ask you, for you, what was the importance of doing this national survey from an institution, and how was it affected not only in the opening but also conceptually about how it went, the title even, Estamos Bien, was it affected in any manner by the context of?
Well, the title obviously came from COVID. We had to postpone the opening of La Trienal because of COVID. And a lot of the curators decide to take that opportunity to consider new artists and also to change the title and reframe the way that La Trinal had to be conceptualized. So yes, it responded to that very unique condition, but also to Black Lives Matter. So for a cultural-specific institution, for a museum, I didn't say that, it was founded in 1969 in the years of the civil rights movement, and it was founded by the Young Lords, by some of the members of the Young Lords. So activism, civil rights were like part of the early thinking of the founders of El Museo del Barrio. We are an institution that has a very fascinating political history. So we do deeply care about being a very inclusive institution and an institution that is helping to diversify the cultural experience in the U.S. So La Trinal was a really, really ease because we're opening in October 9th. You're all invited our next Trinal. La Trinal really became an opportunity to show in a very interesting platform the national production of the Latinx community, and I insist, a production that has very low visibility, but I think that shows what kind of conversation, situations, conflict, tensions the Latinos are experiencing in different areas of the U.S. So yes, it became an opportunity to the COVID and Black Lives Matter to rethink and reframe La Trinal. And La Trinal became also a very important opportunity to put in the eyes of everyone the production of Latinos and to open different conversations about exclusion, marginality, and the things that really are often experienced by artists producing in the U.S., Latino artists producing in the U.S.
Also, continuing with the La Trinal, as it was focused on Latinx artists, in the curatorial text I was reading in the catalog, it is said that the Latinx term is much contested. I wanted to ask, firstly, by whom it is contested, this term, and it is also mentioned that it's used as a way of departing of binary understandings that can happen here of U.S. and Latino culture. But I wanted to ask both of you, conceptually, what do you think of this term Latinx, if, for example, you, Ignacio, identify with it or not? And yeah, if you think also Western thought is inherently binary, and in so what ways?
So yeah, I think somehow like language, we're supposed to use it as in an expansive way. Somehow I do think that ourselves, like, because we come from Latin America, we come from, like, you know, like these places, we really think about it somehow within our own experiences. I would say, like, more richly, you know, than somehow I see in some other peers from North America. Think about it and try using it in a different way somehow to, like, mostly, like, probably more categorized, you know. I think we have language to be expanded. Language is, like, somehow something that we own, co-create. So in a way that I think that's positive, but if we take it that way, you know, if we, like, really understand language as something that is being co-created, like, daily within us, you know, and, like, as Patrick says, like, trying to understand these complexities, you know, because, like, our identities aren't simple, are complex, right? And they cannot be translated into what, you know, that North American gays sometimes try to wait it on, you know. So I think it's a conversation, and it's an ongoing conversation. Yeah.
Well, the word was introduced in the beginning, focusing exclusively on gender. So instead of saying Latino or Latina, you could say Latinx, and it was more inclusive. But now, at least in the field of art and culture, it has become mainly when we talk about the production of people that have that come from the Caribbean, from Mexico, Central America, and South America, and that already really are integrated in the cultural, economic, and political production of the U.S. So now, at least, I believe that it's interesting, because for an institution like the Museo del Barrio, I think it brings more complexity in the conversation of identities, of the different identities. And el Museo del Barrio has embraced the term because we feel that it's interesting to frame those conversations with more complexity than before.
I think it's also interesting that the term Latinx has this gender ambiguity. But when you also think about Latin languages, they have the feminine and the masculine, you know, embedded into them, as opposed to the English language, which uses the neutral. Wouldn't it, like, the Latinx term be, in a way, this acceptance of a cultural assimilation?
Yeah, I think it comes from there. So I totally agree, but I have to, with the purpose of bringing also more complexity to the discussion and conversation around Latinx, the book of Gerardo Mosquera that inspired the title of the cycle of panels and conversations. Gerardo Mosquera says that he doesn't believe that there is that Mexican art exists, or French art, or a German art, or Brazilian art. The only thing that really exists is art from Mexico, from Germany, from Brazil, which is completely different, because instead of essentializing or exoticizing, to use the term that you introduced moments ago, instead of exoticizing or essentializing identities, when you say from, you're focusing on the context, on historical, economical, social, and political contexts, and that's completely different from believing that there is, like, a kind of essential cultural identity in a region. So if we frame this idea of Gerardo Mosquera from the perspective of Latinx, it becomes very complicated, because Latinx is not only about producing, being Latinos producing in this context, it's about really focusing of your historical identity. In general, Latinx, if you see Chicano art, there is an obsession in Chicano art, really interesting obsession about Mexican cultural roots. So that's why you see so much Aztec art in Frida Kahlo's, and these kind of things are very often represented in Chicano art. So when you frame this discussion about cultural identity from the perspective of Gerardo Mosquera, it becomes much more difficult. And I love how this incredible book complicates my position, the position of an institution like El Museo del Barrio.
Totally. And yeah, I feel like in the art history, we've, like, learned to know that art canons and universal terms are kind of superseded, we believe that, no? So, in a way, that by that, we added now much complexities stemming from the context of artists and stuff. But at the same time, I believe we are all using the same kind of structural models that we play into, no? Like, not only the contemporary art, minimalism, conceptualism, how has that ingrained in the practices, but also in just the economic models that we all play with, no? Just and that has a lot to do with your work, Ignacio, also. So, for example, you had this exhibition, Sujeto Cuantificado, at BONAM in Washington, D.C., just last year ago, curated by Isabella Achenbach. And it was quite a reflection on the abstraction that the economy has, no? And statistics. Can you tell us a little bit more about that exhibition?
Yes. Well, it really started from the personal experience that I had during these like 3 years or 4 years that have passed. But coming back to the subject of like language and that situation of like complexities that it brings to, I think that was my opportunity to really bring it on and kind of like try to use finance as a model for speaking about it. And in terms of like, for example, what we say of like abstraction of meanings, right? Basically, what I try to say about that is like we really don't understand finance as well, these numbers, for example, these measurement systems, for example, but we see them daily and it passes through our eyes and like it really informs our experience, but we really don't have either time or knowledge to really grasp it. And I wanted to poetically kind of like approach that. And that's the exhibition mainly like about substantially. But as an example of it, to not sound like kind of like whatever, it's like I really was obsessed with the New York Stock Exchange back then when I was walking around like New York and like those times where I was wandering around those empty stores in Madison Avenue. I somehow always ended there in the financial district. And I'm still obsessed with the financial district in New York and the history of it. And I was looking at the stock ticker display with all those numbers that were very down back then in COVID times and what it really meant as an historical timeline. And then I wanted to use that, so I created a software with my friend Esteban Serrano, that he's a programmer, to kind of emulate that. And so we brought data from the New York Stock Exchange to the gallery, basically, and then for it to be an interactive exhibition that people could like play with it, with these credit cards that I programmed. That each one in their magnetic strip, it has encrypted this text, our poetic, that disrupts the flow of the stock ticker display. That's an example.
Also, that exhibition in the curatorial text is mentioned how the word Visa was used by the first banks because it's a word that can be used in almost any language and it's quite recognizable. And talking about this kind of universality that goes into play with economic models and stuff. I think it's very interesting when we analyze this kind of word, Visa, how we know it, of course, as a credit card, but also for a Latin American like me, as a visa that you need to enter the U.S. And it's not really when you encounter like the border patrol that you really recognize yourself as a Latin American as much as you feel assimilated into Western culture. But, for example, do you, Ignacio, think that this using these symbols that we all recognize, even more abstract symbols such as the Nike checkmark and other logos and stuff, can these symbols be used to critique its own system?
I think it's more to to rethink about them, because it's not like, because like the first kind of like layer of what interpretation would it be that, but it's really more about the excess of like our agency towards the lack of substantial meaning that those symbols could have versus our potential, again, excess of meaning that we could bring into the table of that specific landscape of science. So, I mean, to kind of ground it down and explain it easily, I think it's like, it's basically poetry, right, versus political language, for example, right? In political language, we have a bunch of like words that really don't mean anything. And in poetry, we can have like three words that means everything. So basically, that's the dichotomy of, I feel like, that specific. I think I kind of like went out a little bit. But coming back from the visa thing, I think about the credit card as this like entry point, or that we probably will have, or you know, we all have touched, and we have a memory of it. We have a memory of how we use it, and that could, we could think, or I would like to think that we could, that could also be disrupted somehow. So that's what I tried to bring in that show. Yeah.
And you also use a lot of cards, swiping the card, and that's a thing that you use poetically. For me, for example, applying it to daily life, it was very much a shock coming to New York, and now that you have to use a contactless card everywhere, like even in the subway. So suddenly, it's quite inaccessible, this city. Like just going into the subways is quite a hard task if you don't play into these economic models.
I would like to put an example of a very disruptive piece of a Mexican artist that works with this kind of a control system, economical and control system, which is a Minerva Cuevas piece that is done with core barcodes. So what Minerva Cuevas did, he went to one of the most marginal areas in economical terms in Mexico City, and she found that there was a big supermarket in that area. Obviously, a supermarket that I don't know how well they did, because it was too expensive for the economic situation of the neighborhood where it was located. So what she did, she falsificated códigos de barras. She falsificated with someone that really knows about how they function and how they're codified. And what she did, she went and she changed the prices of the products. She put stickers with new barcodes, changing the products of the canasta básica, the things that are more consumed in those areas. And she changed, so people, when they went to pay, without knowing, they were paying much less. Like a Robin Hood, in the spirit of improving conditions in the area, and not really affecting a big supermarket company. She was really introducing a disruptive element using the same system. I mean, playing their own game, but improving the social conditions of the area.
Minerva Cuevas is a great example. She also issued like these student cards that for people to go into museums for free and use this as student benefits. And she has a great body of work. Moving on also to you, Patrick, I wanted to address La Trienal that is happening this year in October. It's after the last Trienal. This one is titled Flow States, and it's set to include 33 artists working in the U.S., Puerto Rico. But not only that, for the first time, it's expanding into more geographies. So can you tell us a bit about that, and what has changed, what lessons have been learned since the last triennial.
What is really important when you're a culture-specific museum, the risk is that with the purpose of highlighting the production of your own community, sometimes you really close everything. You become an institution that is not open to the production of different communities, and I think what Rodrigo and Susana and
Maria Elena,
Maria Elena Larios, what they're really trying is to expand the notion of Latinx and trying to identify the production of Latinos that have lived in the U.S., that have, but are also replaced in different geographies. And I think this, I'm happy. I've been dreaming for a long time to present an exhibition at the Museo del Barrio that established a conversation between the production of the Middle East communities in New York and Latinos, because we have experienced very similar things. And I want to bring also those voices to El Museo and open. So I think it's important when you're a culture-specific institution to be trying always to bring different voices that resonate in different ways with your own community.
And within this framework of La Triennale, what, if not a geographical matter now, because artists not necessarily have to be in this epicenter such as New York or Los Angeles or these big cities, what is it that it ties together, the selection of works that are there?
It's because when you're trying to decide what is Latinx identity, going to the geographical argument is very limited. So I think this is the main reason why they want to bring those artists from Asia, from other areas of the Caribbean, other areas of Latin America. They want to bring them and really open, a complex conversation about what really means to be a Latinx artist and what it really means to be thinking about your background, your community, your family. And I'm very excited. I mean, I haven't seen it because I'm not curating. I'm just celebrating the work that our curators are doing. But I'm very excited, and I think it will open interesting conversations about the Latinx art in the U.S. and the Latinx art beyond this geographical location.
Oh, for sure. I think this, of course, is a conversation that has many more topics to be discussed, and it's an endless thing of visiting case-specific studies of each artist and each exhibition that we're making. I don't know how we're running on time now, if we're good. Oh, perfect. Yeah, I don't know if the public has any questions, and if not, thank you, Ignacio Gatica and Patrick Charpener, for being here with us. We'll have at 9 p.m. starting a DJ set by M. Peach, a wonderful musician from Venezuela. I welcome all the public to stay around and have a drink with us and keep listening to us in MontesPressRadio.com.
Gracias.